I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Democrats are down to the wire and they don't have the votes. Republicans are crying foul about a potential new strategy. Get ready to hear about sidecars, slaughter solutions, and deemed bills. It may be the last few days of debate over health care reform before a vote as early as Thursday. So let's start today with a check-in. Karen Tumulty is senior political correspondent for Time magazine. Karen, what's happening today?
There's a lot of kind of scurrying back and forth where they are trying to count noses and twist arms. They're just trying to get to the goal line.
But how are they doing that? Nancy Pelosi was asked if she'd make changes in the bill to appeal to Democratic holdouts in particular. She said no. Politico quotes a Democratic official saying there will be no horse trading. They are closed for business.
Oh, of course there's going to be horse trading. There just won't be horse trading on this bill. But certainly, there's going to be a lot of offers. Do you want the president to come campaign for you in your district this fall? What about this other piece of legislation that you're interested in? What about that grant for your district? So they can argue that there will be no more, you know, infamous Cornhusker kickbacks, special deals in this bill for one member or one state. But there is plenty of dealing that is going to go on between now and the vote.
And that's behind closed doors. What about in public? Has there been a shift in strategy? Because we heard yesterday about the woman who paid almost $10,000 in premiums to her insurance company and got only about $900 in benefits from her insurer. We hadn't heard these kinds of stories from the White House, and some analysts are saying it's because they made that deal early on not to demonize the industry in order to get it on board. So is that deal with the industry completely off? Is that what we're seeing?
No. I think what has happened here is that the headlines have handed the administration and the Democrats an enormous gift. In the last few weeks, we have seen a whole series of insurance companies announce gigantic rate increases in the individual market, people who have to go out and buy their own coverage because they don't get it at work. And in a lot of places, they are going to be seeing their premiums, most notoriously, I think, Anthem Blue Cross in California, going up by 30%. And so essentially, they are trying to take their talking points here out of the headlines. And that's probably a smart strategy because this is not just about covering the uninsured.
Well, in fact, the woman we're speaking of and the president spoke of yesterday, Natoma Canfield, had to drop her coverage, she said, because she wasn't getting enough out of it. And her insurance company was Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield in Ohio.
That's right. It's also, you know, the latest tone from the administration on all of this has been a sort of a populist us against them, you against your insurance company, and this is a way of getting back at them.
Well, explain the way Democrats in the House might bring all of this to a vote. They're calling it the Slaughter Resolution. It's named after Rules Committee Chair Louise Slaughter. It would automatically enact the Senate bill, deem it passed, if the House approves a rule for consideration of changes to the bill. Those changes are called the sidecar. So, phew, you know, all these little names. What does that mean? Does that help the House actually avoid a vote by sort of automatically saying something is deemed a law?
No, because everybody is going to recognize this vote on the rule for what it is, which is really a vote on the underlying bill. But what they are trying to avoid is the attack ads that will come against their members on things that the House members don't want, that they want to change, including things like the Cornhusker kickback, you know, the so-called Cadillac tax on high-priced health insurance. All that stuff is going to get changed between the Senate bill that they have to pass and the final version that they're going to work out with the Senate. So it's kind of an effort to airbrush this vote.
So, in fact, they're saying we'll make the changes first. We'll sort of, you know, do the sidecar first, which are all the changes. And then when they finally vote on a bill, it'll be the one that they've made the changes in.
Exactly.
Well, Republicans, by the way, are saying Democrats are making this up as they go along. Slaughter's Rules Committee says this has been done before. Either way, Karen, are we looking at some late nights in the next few days?
Oh, my goodness. Yes, we are. One thing that is kind of focusing them on this weekend is the fact that they all want to get out of town and get home for the Easter recess, and they want this behind them by the time that they do that.
Karen Tumulty, senior political correspondent for Time magazine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the National League of Cities is for health care reform because they say it will lower costs. But some cities are also eyeing breaking existing contracts with loopholes that allow, for instance, for health care for life for a worker who leaves after 20 years on the job, or co-payments of just $5 compared to the $15 or $20 most people pay. In Scottsdale, Arizona, single city workers can pay just $12 a month for coverage. That's according to the Arizona Republic. In a few minutes, what's happening across the country. But first, the Boston Globe reviewed 6 months of municipal health plans here in Massachusetts and found costs doubled from 2001 to 2008, adding $1 billion to city and town budgets. Sean Murphy is an investigative reporter for the Globe. And Sean, you start off the series with a story about a woman who worked first in Salem, Mass. For 12 years, then as a city planner in Everett, Massachusetts for 8 years, and ended up with health care for life at the ripe old age of 42. How did that happen?
Well, this is like hitting the lottery, really. I mean, it's worth about $1 million. She was the beneficiary of a quirk of Massachusetts state law. It is a so-called termination pension, which allows for her to retire after 20 years at any age, so long as her job was, quote, terminated. And thus, she had 20 years on the job when a new mayor came in, 12 years in Salem, 8 years in Everett, and she was out the door. And so it is in Massachusetts, probably unlike any place under the sun, that she gets full benefits at age 42. She has a pension, a sizable, well, $25,000, I think, as a pension every year. But more valuable, in some sense, is the health care benefits that she has for her and her family.
And be clear, she did not manipulate the system.
No, not at all. I mean, she did not, as so far as I can tell, create a fiction whereby she was, quote, fired in order to realize that. And believe me, Robin, you well know such things have happened in Massachusetts. She simply looked up what the benefits were available to her under those circumstances and took them.
And how often does this happen?
This 20-year deal, I've identified several hundred.
That's several hundred million dollars.
It's a lot of money.
And how, for instance, would those benefits compare to the private sector? I mean, in the private sector, can someone get benefits for life?
No. Well, you remember GM. GM, of course, did make lavish promises to its retirees, and that's one of the things that brought GM to its knees. Many of those benefits have since been abandoned. My experts tell me that less than one quarter of private sector employees get any benefit at all in retirement.
And one of the problems that you write about these promises of benefits for life is that these are unfunded. I mean, is the money there to do this?
No. No, it isn't. Of course not. What would be the fun of that? The city of Boston alone has promised $5.7 billion worth of health care benefits. The city of Lynn has promised $450 million, which is five times as much as its annual tax levy.
And is part of the problem that people are being fired early or retiring early, whatever it is that triggers this promise of benefits?
Well, it is. The firing early is a subcategory. My research says the vast majority of police, firefighters, and teachers retire well before age 65. Thus, they begin realizing their health care benefits as retirees long before age 65.
Right. Well, and you mentioned the age 65. That's another issue you discovered. Cities aren't requiring their former employees to go on Medicare when they turn 65. Why not? And remind us how that costs taxpayers.
We all probably know by now, because of the national debate on health care, that Medicare is a huge entitlement. It begins at age 65, and it's available to everybody. So when people hit 65, they go on it, but it doesn't pay for everything, not by a long shot. And almost everyone who can afford it purchases a supplemental plan. It costs $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 a year. In the public sector, those plans, those supplemental plans, are paid for by taxpayers. In addition.
For retirees.
For retirees. That's correct. But it's even more egregious than that, Robin, because there are thousands of retirees who are Medicare eligible. They're 65, eligible for Medicare. They should take it, but they don't. Instead, they continue on the municipality's plan for full coverage. In effect, municipalities that don't force Medicare-eligible folks onto Medicare are leaving tens of millions of dollars on the table. For you and I and all of us in the private sector, when we turn 65, we, as by virtue of us having paid taxes all these years, will get the Medicare benefit. In the municipalities, Medicare-eligible people are not being forced into that existing benefit, which is there for the taking. Instead, they're enjoying what they think is better benefits from the municipality itself. It's kind of a mirage because the benefits are essentially the same. And the consequence is that the federal government is not paying that amount and the municipalities are.
Why would municipalities allow this? Why aren't they?
Politics. It's politics. Retirees, you may well know, are very loyal voters, often active in groups and associations, and they come to their opinions and they tend to be firm about them. Many retirees simply don't want to go to Medicare. It represents change at the very least, and they don't want to undertake it. They have the ability, they've demonstrated the ability, to let their local city councilors and state legislators know how they feel. And thus, they have blocked those public officials from moving them onto Medicare.
Well, and how much money do you think that is costing the state?
Oh, it's $100 million.
And what further can other cities see happening here in Massachusetts because these municipal benefits costs are skyrocketing? What else gets cut?
Well, we know already that library hours have been cut. Potholes are not filled as quickly. City halls close on Friday afternoons or all day Friday. Those are kind of on the edges. What really needs to happen if there's no relief here are layoffs.
We mentioned the politics. You write that the state legislature here in Massachusetts did try to pass a law that would help reduce costs. What happened?
The legislature in 2007 made a run at this issue, and they passed a bill which would give municipalities greater authority to reduce health care benefits. However, it contained a provision requiring a 70% vote of approval from the unions, and that has proven to be nearly impossible.
Well, and people in those unions, city employees, would say they tend to make less money than in the private sector. They fought hard for those benefits, that in fact it's the benefit that's more important to them than even the salary.
There has been historically some trade-off for wages in order to get higher benefits. That's true. Another factor that you have to think about is that when these benefits were accumulated by the unions over the years, it was before the huge run-up in health care costs. So municipalities and the taxpayers, by extension, didn't anticipate that there'd be a 200 or 300% increase in 10 years over on the cost of health care, and that benefit would enlarge the total compensation package that municipal workers would get.
That's Sean Murphy, investigative reporter for the Boston Globe. And as we just said, city employees fought hard for their benefits. They're not so willing to give them up. But as we're going to hear, the voters may have a say in that. We're going to have a few more minutes with Sean. But also, when we come back on the other side of a break, we'll take a look at this issue of soaring health care costs in cities across the country. Also later today, a woman who rejects the Church of Scientology but is still keeping her faith. That's later. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. In a minute, we'll look nationwide, but we've been talking about health care costs crippling cities and town budgets here in Massachusetts with Sean Murphy, investigative reporter for the Boston Globe. And Sean, we just wanted to wrap up with you by asking, what do you think will change here, if anything?
I'm tempted to say nothing, but it depends on the public, and it depends on how economic times are over the next couple of years. I think it's the first option for the legislature, frankly, to do nothing, to sort of retrench and hold over and expect that it'll blow over. The question is, will the backlash, if it occurs, as has already been demonstrated in the Scott Brown election, will the electoral backlash be enough that the legislature and the governor decide that something has to change?
Do you think that the Scott Brown election reflected this kind of anger? Because many who voted for Scott Brown were probably in this group.
I tend to believe it does, Robin. I've been a reporter in Boston for 25 years, and I get the sense that these are the times where people will pay attention very closely to questions of economic benefits. They're looking for their legislature to do something, perhaps even innovative, to improve their quality of life.
Sean Murphy, investigative reporter for the Boston Globe, who looked at the rising health care costs in Massachusetts cities and towns. Sean, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
So how are these costs affecting other cities and towns? The National League of Cities estimates that municipalities spent $87 billion on employee health benefits last year, 18% of their budgets, up from 10% a decade ago. Neil Bomberg lobbies Congress for the National League of Cities. And Neil, you agree that one of the reasons for rising costs are these traditional pacts that cities make with public workers for lower salaries but higher benefits. But mayors here in Massachusetts recently met, and they want to put this before the voters. In 2012, they want a ballot question to ask if cities can break those contracts and pacts. Are other cities considering similar measures?
Well, certainly, I think cities and towns across the country, as well as states, are looking at various ways to reduce their overall costs. Having said that, there is no question that this will alter the relationships that have existed historically between employers and employees. But as is the case so often, whether it be in the private or the public sector, it is incumbent upon employees and employers alike to revisit their agreements, to try to make remake those agreements in ways that ensure that workers continue to be adequately paid and adequately rewarded, but also so that taxpayers are not overwhelmed by huge fiscal and financial burden.
Do you see cities and towns doing this, saying that we've got to review this either by changing statutes, putting it before voters? Do you see anyone else doing that?
We know that cities and towns across the country have indicated that as the recession continues and as their coffers begin to diminish, they are looking at all sorts of ways to reduce expenditures.
What are some of the ways? We are hearing about state-based risk pools.
Yes. One of the things that has been very effective to help reduce their overall health care costs is to come together as larger entities. For example, in the state of Texas, a very large number of cities and towns have come together, pooled their employees, if you will, to create a risk pool that is able to go out and purchase insurance at significantly lower rates. I was looking at the pricing that was indicated in the Boston Globe article and was actually quite amazed at some of the per family costs, because we know that in Texas, where states and localities are providing excellent levels and excellent quality of health care coverage, they are managing to keep their costs down to about $6,000 for individuals and about $8,000 for families. In Massachusetts, according to the Globe article, the cost for an individual is about $8,000. The cost for a family is about $34,000.
We also know that cities and towns are trying to raise revenue since they've lost some of the tax base because of, you know, businesses going away. How are they trying to raise revenue?
Well, they're looking at some creative solutions. Right here in the District of Columbia, the city of Washington recently created what they're calling a bag tax, a 5-cent per bag tax that individuals pay when they shop in a store that sells food.
We understand cities are also doing things like, well, here in Massachusetts, there's debate about sin taxes on sodas and junk food.
Yes, and New York City is clearly looking at that. Cities and towns have run out of taxes on cigarettes and alcohol. The demand is diminishing, so they are looking to other places where demand is quite high, and soda is one of those. If it begins to change behavior, there is a long-term loss of that revenue, but in the short term, it may help cities and towns get through the fiscal crisis that they are currently experiencing related to this recession.
Well, meantime, we understand the National League of Cities, as a collective group, backs health care reform. Is that simply because of the rising cost of health care that they're seeing?
First and foremost, we are deeply concerned about the uninsured, and look at the legislation moving through the House and Senate right now as a way to address a substantial part of that problem. We want cities and towns to be able to be as creative and innovative as they can be in the provision provision of health care to their employees. You raise the issue of the risk pools. That is one vehicle that many, many state municipal leagues are pulling together, putting together for their cities and towns. But there also is another vehicle that many cities and towns use, and that is that they self-insure. That is that they underwrite the costs of people going to their physician, people going to hospitals, right out of their own budgets. They set those funds aside. They make sure that there are sufficient funds to cover that, but it is a cost-saving mechanism, and the administrative costs of such a program are quite low. And both of these vehicles would be permitted under the current health reform legislation.
Neil Bomberg lobbies Congress on behalf of the National League of Cities. He's been speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Neil, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure to join you.
So what do you think about this story or anything on the program, especially if you are a city worker? We'd love to hear from you. Go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us. You can send an email that way or scroll down and leave a comment right there, hereandnow.org. Latest news is next, Here and Now. There are a number of safety deposit boxes in a number of banks in a number of countries. Individuals, countries, and institutions are all locked in a legal battle over the contents. If Franz Kafka were writing this story, they'd all be empty. And in fact, Kafka has written the end to this story, because what's in those safety deposit boxes once belonged to him. From Jerusalem, the BBC's Katya Adler explains.
The celebrated 20th century writer Franz Kafka became famous in spite of himself. Just before he died of illness in 1924, he gave his close friend Max Pod, a fellow German-speaking Czech Jew, a sheaf of handwritten papers, instructing him to burn the manuscripts after his death. Pod ignored Kafka's dying wish, enabling the world to enjoy Kafka greats, such as the trial.
Someone must have been telling lies about Joseph K. He knew he had done nothing wrong, but one fine morning he was arrested. Every day at
an ardent Zionist, Kafka's friend Max Pod fled the Nazis, coming to Tel Aviv in 1939. He formed a close relationship with his secretary, Esther Hoffer, also an émigré from Prague. When he died, he made her the custodian of his estate, which included Franz Kafka's papers. And here, the plot thickens. Esther Hoffer sold a number of Kafka's manuscripts at auction. She insisted they were hers to do with what she wished. When she died a few years ago, she left the contents of the estate to her two daughters. The papers, possibly including great literary treasures, no one is quite sure, are locked in safety deposit boxes in Switzerland and in Israel. But Israel's National Library is now fighting a bitter legal battle to get hold of the estate. By rights, it insists Kafka's papers belong to Israel. 75-year-old Eva Hoffer says she's devastated at how her mother's memory is being tainted.
It looks to me like people are putting my life on the street, because all this belongs to my private life. I'm not married, and I have no children. I had only this, and the country cannot go inside.
Here on the arts campus at Jerusalem's Hebrew University, a number of academics have written an open letter, arguing that Max Brod's estate and whatever may be left of Kafka's manuscripts must be kept here.
We enter now into my office, and the first dominant presence is, of course, of Franz Kafka.
Dov Kulka is a professor of Jewish history, also formerly from Prague. He says Kafka is part of Israel's cultural heritage.
Kafka is very popular. They are reading it in schools, of course. There are plays of theater here. He belongs to the intellectual map of Israel. They look to the European sources of their identity. And Franz Kafka fascinates them.
But Eva Hoffer insists Israeli libraries are not equipped to care for precious manuscripts. She favors selling them to a German library.
Here in Israel, there is no place for it. We have other things here to do. We have terror, we have everything. Sorry, but culture is coming later.
Something Israel's National Library vehemently disputes.
Shh. In front of me on a table is one of the great treasures of Israel's National Library. I've been allowed to approach with care and with gloves as well. What I'm looking at is a notebook belonging to Franz Kafka. He's learning Hebrew here, proof that not only was he interested in the language, but according to his diaries, he had every intention of moving to what was then Palestine. I've come here to meet the lawyer for Israel's National Library, Meir Heller.
The place for the great Jewish scholars, writers, should be here in Israel, like Albert Einstein, that we have his archive. He had a dream of coming to Tel Aviv and opening up a restaurant. He wanted to be a waiter.
And the great literary writer?
Yes.
Wanted to be a waiter?
Yes, he was not an ordinary fellow, as you can imagine.
The fierce battles being fought over Franz Kafka's papers in Max Brod's estate are Kafkaesque in themselves. Trials are being held over whether to forcibly open safety deposit boxes, but no one's quite sure how many there are and what exactly is in them. The melancholic and sardonic Kafka is probably smiling wryly in his grave.
The BBC's Katya Adler reporting from Jerusalem. Well, coming up, a Scientologist rejects the church but keeps her faith in 30 seconds here and now. Three-year-old Christy Colbrand was raised a Scientologist, married one. She and her husband served as members of Scientology's elite leadership group, the Sea Org, so-called because members like founder L. Ron Hubbard originally wore uniforms and lived aboard ships. But the couple became disillusioned with what they called physical and financial abuse at the highest levels of the church. So, Christy says, since Sea Org members are not allowed to have children, she intentionally became pregnant. Church officials handed her and her husband each a $40,000 freeloader bill and declared them suppressive persons, forbidden to speak with family and friends in the church. All this, and Christy, now the mother of a three-year-old, who first told her story to the New York Times, still calls herself a Scientologist. She's left the church, but she still believes in what many people call a cult. She joins us from WUSF in Tampa, Florida. And Christy, we've heard from celebrities like Tom Cruise, but what do you think Scientology is?
Yeah, well, Scientology, the purpose of it is basically to help individuals improve their happiness, their confidence. There's courses you can take. There's counseling you can do.
Is this too simple to say that the goal is also to remove negativity from the world? In other words, if you get happy, to try to make sure other people are happy too.
That's absolutely correct.
Well, and then to sort of clear your mind of the negativity, we understand there are auditing sessions using something called an e-reader.
E-meter. Yeah.
Tell us about those.
Auditing is basically, you know, it comes from a Latin word, audire, which means to listen. And the auditor basically sits with you and asks various questions. And you look for areas in your past that have bothered you or troubled you and sort of try to release the negative energy that exists in those moments of time in your past. And by doing that, it doesn't have any power over you anymore. And you can feel free from it and, you know, more able to move forward in your life without having those negative things holding you back.
Well, okay, quick question here. And first, an acknowledgement. Every faith requires, well, a leap of faith. Either a belief in the life hereafter or a man who could part waters or walk on water, for that matter. So, you know, every faith embraces these things. But was there any time along the way as you were growing up that you questioned your faith in Scientology? You questioned this idea that you had to pay money, for instance, to get to different levels of faith. You had to go through these auditing sessions. Did you ever question that?
I don't have any questions about my faith. I find it to be very workable for me. I like it. Actually, I love it. But what I did have problems with was the leader of the Church of Scientology, David Miscavige, is involved in abuse, and he's using the finances for things that they weren't really intended for. Basically, people are donating their money so they can do courses and receive the auditing sessions that we talked about. And it also is supposed to be used for social betterment activities that the church is involved with. But, you know, some of it is being used for David Miscavige to have a $2 million home. And he came to South Africa when I was working there. He flew over in Tom Cruise's airplane. He was wearing a very, very expensive suit. All of his direct subordinates were dressed to the nines. He stayed in the most expensive hotel. He went out to dinner with several of his staff members, and my husband included, went to that dinner, and they spent, you know, $7,000 to $9,000 on that dinner alone.
And meanwhile, you and your husband were, did I read this correctly, you and your husband were making about $17?
A week.
A week. But what's worse and more damning is that you and your husband say that you saw physical abuse.
Well, my husband's the one who actually saw direct physical abuse. He saw David Miscavige's subordinates slap another person in the face about 10 or 15 times. When other former executives of Scientology left and told stories of even more severe abuse, we weren't surprised, and it made sense to us because David Miscavige is very antagonistic, he's arrogant, and he's the one who is a suppressive person, as opposed to the people that are leaving that are now being declared suppressives.
Well, and yeah, you have been declared a suppressive. You were cut off from family, friends.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of a church would do that?
A church that's definitely not following its original purpose. So yeah, it's definitely off the course. I mean, my parents are two of the most important people in the entire world to me, and for the church to come between us has definitely been one of the most heartbreaking things I've ever had to go through. But I was going to stick with my integrity. I was going to do what I felt was right. I tried to actually speak to my parents about everything and explain things to them because they don't have all the information. But the organization and the church members got there before I could finish explaining things to my parents. And my parents were convinced that they needed to disconnect from me. So they did.
We understand from the article in the New York Times that your mother called you a snake in the grass.
She did. But I really don't believe that my mother actually believes that. And I do know that she loves me and I love her. And I really feel that the church is the influence because never in her life has she ever said anything like that to me prior to this.
Well, in response, by the way, the church says that what you're saying about abuse isn't true. They point to what they say is a rise in membership. They've got a project in Florida in which they've bought 54 office buildings and they're building a huge center there. And also that the church is better off without the defectors like you.
Yeah. Well, they're saying that all of us are liars. There's quite a few people coming out with the same story. I don't know how all of these people could have gotten together and come up with the same story. The truth of the matter is a lot of the statistics and information that is being provided to the general public about its expansion is actually false. People are leaving. It's not as big and booming as he makes it out to be. He talks about all these big, beautiful buildings, but he doesn't actually have the statistics to prove that the membership is expanding.
Christy, can you be a Scientologist without being a part of this very secretive organization? And there's a whole other level that I understand you don't even really know about yet because you haven't gotten there that has to do with a story of an alien. But without being able to pay in to the church, can you be a Scientologist and keep progressing?
The religion is also written down in books that are available in bookstores and in libraries. There's a lot of people that have left that have been highly trained who can deliver the levels that you would receive in the church. So there are people you can go to outside of the church that are happy to help you. And I have had some auditing outside of the church, and it was wonderful.
And yet your husband disagreed. He's completely severed. He's not a Scientologist anymore?
Yeah. My husband decided he didn't want to be a Scientologist at all. He didn't have the same gains that I had from the religion prior to the trauma that he went through. Right. So to him, he didn't see the value of remaining a Scientologist.
So you are both divorcing. How are you going to raise your son? A Scientologist?
I'm not going to push him in any direction. I'm going to let him figure it out for himself. And if he needs help or he has questions, I'll absolutely help him. But I'm not going to push him in any specific direction. I want him to have his own determinism and to come to his own conclusions, and I think that's really the best way to do it.
That's Christy Colbrand, a Scientologist who said she left the Church of Scientology over what she and her husband saw as physical and financial abuse by church officials, speaking to us from the studios of WUSF in Tampa, Florida. Christy, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Maine State Representative Henry Joy has introduced a bill to divide his state in two. The North would remain Maine. The South would be renamed Northern Massachusetts. Never mind that New Hampshire takes up some real estate between Maine and the existing Massachusetts. It's not the first time Representative Joy has proposed the split to give the North more autonomy, and it's far from the first attempt to create a new state. Author Michael Trinkline has collected some of the wannabes in the new book, Lost States, True Stories of Texel, Oklahoma, Transylvania, and other states that never made it. He's also drawn maps of what might have been. We'll have some on our website. And he joins us from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Michael, welcome.
Glad to be here.
What got you started on this?
You know, I was a kid who grew up in the 60s and 70s when all the gas stations gave away free maps, and I just would pore over those maps. It was always really exciting to me to kind of guess, why did they put that line there? Why did they put that road there? And I just kind of captured my imagination.
Well, let's start with a few that you found. The first, boy, it would not have been as big a musical, I don't think, if it was Texlahoma. What was Texlahoma?
Texlahoma was born of a desire for better roads. I mean, back in the early 20s, everybody was getting these new Model Ts, and they all wanted better roads. And the problem was is that people in rural counties like northern Texas and western Oklahoma weren't getting these roads. So they figured the only way they were going to get attention is to form their own state so they could actually get the kind of infrastructure they wanted for their cars. And that's where Texlahoma came from.
Because it was a move to sort of get new roads in that area. But as you point out, the problem was that, you know, one of the big things about being from Texas is that you were from Texas, not Texlahoma.
Yeah, that's the thing. There have been so many plans over the years to slice up Texas, you know, like a pizza. But every time it kind of comes up against this point that who is going to be the real Texas? Nobody wants to be South Texas or East Texas. They all want to be just Texas.
Right. Well, let's move on from Texlahoma to Absaroka. Where's this?
Well, that's what I thought, too. It's actually pronounced Absaroka, and it's the best.
Why? I'm so sorry.
It's the best place to grow grass in the entire United States. And really, the same people who created the great tourist attraction called Mount Rushmore thought up this idea, which is they were going to create their own state. They actually had a Miss Absaroka contest, only one. And so theoretically, she's still wearing her tiara, waiting to give it to the second one.
Well, and this was an idea to take pieces of Montana, Wyoming, South Dakota, but that they failed in. They didn't get their own state. Tell us about, am I saying this correctly, Forgottonia, the land Illinois forgot, Forgottonia.
Yeah, these poor people just really wanted an interstate highway. And what they do out there in Forgottonia, and I've been there many times, is they raise corn. It's just all corn. And as long as Americans love high fructose corn syrup, they're going to do pretty well. The problem is that they weren't getting the freeways they wanted, and so they decided they were going to redress their grievances by seceding and forming their own state. Well, as you can see, we don't have Forgottonia quite yet.
Well, and they don't have the roads they wanted.
No, I-72 still doesn't go through. I mean, all these years later, it's supposed to be a shortcut from Kansas City to Chicago, which would have brought great wealth to Forgottonia, but it still hasn't gone through.
Transylvania is another suggestion. Boy, it's so funny because I thought certainly this had something to do with Pennsylvania, but no, it overlays Kentucky.
Yeah, Sylvania is one of these words that means pleasant woodsy area. So Pennsylvania was William Penn's pleasant woodsy area, and Transylvania was really the one that Daniel Boone started. He had hoped to make this a state. This was his first approach in that area. What he did was he sent one of his lieutenants back to the Continental Congress. And unfortunately, the Continental Congress did not go for it. And so Daniel Boone's idea didn't become a state, although a few years later it did become Kentucky. So things have gone a little bit differently. We would have had the Transylvania Derby every year. Now we just have the Kentucky Derby.
Well, and people in the real Transylvania on the other side of the ocean might have had something to say about a state named. And by the way, you heard this story from a descendant of Daniel Boone's?
Yeah, singer Pat Boone, actually, and Debbie Boone, his daughter, actually are direct descendants of Daniel Boone. Yeah.
I did not know that. Shasta. This was an idea floated in 1957. It would have been, well, I'm looking at your map, it would have been Northern California, kind of, you know, right underneath Oregon, along Nevada, up till, well, above Mendocino.
Yeah, here's the thing. I mean, people in the West need water. And Shasta has it, and the rest of California doesn't. And so Shasta wanted to protect their water, and they thought the way to do it was to kind of create their own state. It's kind of emblematic of a larger issue in our country, and that is the desire for water, especially in the West. And as I was researching the Shasta story, I learned about this huge, unbelievable plan to actually take all the water from the Mackenzie River, from, you know, the Arctic Circle, and pump it all to Los Angeles. And this actually was a plan, and it actually had some government support behind it. In fact, if Canada wasn't in the way, we might actually be pumping water from, all of Canada down to L.A. just to keep L.A. and Las Vegas going. So, yeah, that's a story that kind of recurs. We need water, and we got to find ways to get it.
Well, and, of course, the southern part of the state rejected the Shasta statehood proposal. But the debate still goes on.
The debate continues. And, in fact, the debate continues for a lot of states. I mean, I'd like to say that, you know, the American map for most of our history, we argued about it. We fought about it. Like now we're fighting about health care. Well, for most of our history, we were trying to figure out, put the state here, put the state there. No, that's going to be this. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about it. In fact, Barack Obama is the first president who has not seen a new state added in his lifetime.
Yeah, even though Barack Obama grew up in one of the states that was most recently added, as you say, it was added before he was born. That's Hawaii.
Right, yes. Right. Hawaii and Alaska came in 1959. He was born in the early 60s.
So this used to be much hotter.
This was really hot for most of our history. I mean, this, you know, there would be huge fights over, you know, one Dakota or two Dakotas. You know, are we going to make Alaska a state or not? Or, you know, Cuba, for a long time, a lot of Americans thought Cuba was going to become a state. I mean, these are discussions which were hotly debated throughout our history.
Well, Michael Trinklein, obviously this is something that captured you as a child. You've now put it all in a book. Do you think about this? I mean, do you find yourself driving around and thinking, you know, that could have been the state of Sequoia or the state of Navajo, or do you find yourself conscious of it?
All the time. You know, I often think, I wish Montezuma, which was one of the proposed states, would have become a state, because I really wish we'd have an NFL franchise called the Montezuma Revengers. Okay, sorry. That's not a very classy joke for your classy show. I apologize. But no, I do think about it a lot because it, you know, I want Americans to realize that our map is always been kind of a malleable thing. It's not fixed. And we now tend to think of it as, well, we are, and we can't change. But throughout our history, we were really fighting about borders and oftentimes sorting out our differences by sorting out our borders. And this is a story about losers, let's face it. But I mean, even those losers have a lot to say about the American story. A good example might be like the Gadsden Purchase, where we all learned a little bit in grade school. You know, Gadsden bought this little sliver, you know, of Mexico for America. But in reality, what happened was the president sent this guy down there, and he was supposed to buy the whole country, or at least a large part of it. And, you know, he didn't succeed. But the kind of hubris we had as a nation, thinking we could just buy Mexico, kind of tells us a little bit about who we were at that point in history. Or why isn't Cuba a state? Clearly, there's only one reason Cuba's not a state: racism. People in Congress said, we have enough people, in their words, of the Negro race. And that's why Cuba was not a state, because we were afraid. Same thing with Philippines. Philippines might have been a state. There was a concern about too many Filipinos being a part of the United States. So even these losers tell us a lot of, not the people, but of course the statehood proposals, tell us a lot about our history and where we're going, where we've been.
Michael Trinklein, author of Lost States, True Stories of Texelhoma, Transylvania, and Other States That Never Made It. Michael, fascinating. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.